Good afternoon. I'd like to call the House Finance Committee to order. Today is Friday, January 29, 2016. Time is 1:32 p.m. Members present today are Representative Wilson, Guerra, Kawasaki, Vice Chair Sadler, myself, Co-Chair Newman, Representative Gaddis. We do have a couple members that were excused for today's meeting, and some will be in shortly. Today we're going to continue with the FY17 department overviews. First up is the Department of Environmental Conservation, followed by the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Commissioner Harding. And members, as we go along, feel free to ask questions as we do this. Welcome, Representative Gaddis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Larry Hartley, the Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. With me today is Tom Cherian. He's our Director of the Division of Admin Services. So I'm here to give DEC's overview of our proposed fiscal year 2017 budget. My plan, with the Chair's permission, is to have about a half-hour presentation, then open it for questions. Unless you want questions along the way, too.
Yeah, let's just go through the presentation, and then we'll do questions. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you. I'll go through these first one pretty quick so that we get right into the meat of the figures. But as you probably all know by now, DEC's mission is to protect human health and the environment, and those two things we see as inextricably interlinked. You know, that if we protect the environment, that protects human health. The outcomes that we are looking for, of course, are clean water, healthy air, healthy food to eat, good sanitation, and if they try to prevent spills if they occur, to have a rapid containment and response. To put it in real-world terms, that's when you every day go out and, as I put it, you turn on your tap, you don't worry about it, you're drinking clean water, you're not in Flint, Michigan, worrying about lead for you and your kids. You're able to put your garbage out and not worry about where it goes. You don't worry about driving to work and the air that you're breathing. I mean, it's just on and on. We take these things for granted, but there's a lot of work that happens behind the scenes that we and others do for those results. We accomplish those things with science-based standards that we regulate under, and we put these standards into permits and other authorizations that we issue. We do regular monitoring. For instance, you may have read about recently the water system at Talkeetna had some excess arsenic in their waters. Well, that comes to our attention right away because there's regular reports that they send to us, and we have them test for arsenic. We see high numbers, we alert them, and then they go into action, and we work with them to correct the problem. And if there's going to be a delay in that, we notify the public and make sure they're aware, well aware of the situation. And that happens with some regularity. But that's the science-based standards, the standards that we enforce, that we monitor for. And sometimes we enter the emergency response mode with spills. There was a truck spill recently with some hazardous chemicals. We were out on that. And the other thing that we do is we manage a couple of different loan and grant programs, which we'll get into, that provide water and sewer to communities around the state, from the smallest communities to the largest communities. This is the organization of our department. There's the commissioner's office and one deputy, and then there's five divisions, and we'll be covering those five divisions in the presentation. The first division, the Division of Administration, that's Tom Cherian's division, and as you can tell by their name, they're the ones that provide the administrative services, the IT, the financial services, the budgeting, the procurement, managing our facilities. They also house the Environmental Crime Unit, which is just two people. But it's independent of the commissioner's office. It's independent of the programs because it operates across the programs, and we want them to operate with independence. However, they do meet with me and Tom at least once a month to go over the status of all their cases, and if we want to provide any direction, we can. Next division is the largest one, the number of people. It's our Division of Environmental Health. Right now, they're without a director. The director, Elaine Floyd, retired this last summer, and I haven't replaced the director position yet. What we're doing is we're spending this winter to revisit all the things that they do in that division and see if there are some efficiencies that might be had and some consolidations. But we're looking at that in terms of even next year's budget cycle. But the things that they do, the main programs they have are food safety and sanitation, the laboratory services, that's our environmental health lab where the state veterinarian resides, and the public drinking water systems around the state, such as the oversight of the Talkeetna water plant that I just talked about. They also do solid waste management. Those are the landfills all the way from the village landfills to the municipality of Anchorage. The next division is our smallest one. It's the Division of Air Quality. They have a federally delegated program that issues the Clean Air Act permits in the state, both construction and operating permits. They've run that program for over 30 years. I forget the exact amount, but it's probably our longest, by far, delegated program, and a very experienced group. In fact, just before lunch, I came out of a lean exercise that they were just finishing up, looking at our air quality permitting program, and the consultant was going through what with some additional changes that came out of this lean exercise that we were looking at implementing, that we might expect maybe a 15% improvement, you know, in performance. And he said, normally you expect about 50 to 80% out of a program like this. He said, but you guys are already so efficient. That's all we could find. And it didn't surprise me, but that's a well-mature run program, and it's small but very effective. They also do a fair amount of community work, particularly on the transportation side, like in Anchorage and Fairbanks, looking at funding. We get some funding through DOT to work with the local community on transportation plans to make sure that those plans don't impact air quality in ways that we don't want. They also do some air monitoring around the state, although it's somewhat limited, mainly for EPA requirements, but also for forest fires that we have around the state in the summer. DEC supports DNR and other agencies in the air monitoring and issuing air alerts relating to human health concerns. The SPAR division, that's Spill Prevention and Response, it consolidated several of its programs over the last couple of years and has been also driving towards efficiencies. They also have, besides spill preparedness and response, they also have contaminated site program for the cleanup, and then they administer the response fund, which is that used to be just a nickel a barrel surcharge on crude oil, but now it's the 0.95% on refined products too, as you remember from the bill last year. The Division of Water basically has two parts to it. The first part is setting water quality standards, then incorporating those standards into permits. Again, we have a federally delegated program there, the APDS program, which is the Alaska Pollution Discharge Elimination System program that's based on the Federal Clean Water Act. Besides the water quality standard and permitting program, the other side of Division of Water is the facility construction side. And that's the program where we make loans and we make grants to communities of all sizes to fund water and sewer work. There's two programs there, the Village Safe Water, which is for communities of 1,000 people or less, and we get 75% of that money is federal money that comes in, and there's a 25% state match. You would see that in the capital budget. And then we have the Municipal Grant and Loan Program, the municipal grant program. That's a solely state program where the state of Alaska provides funds for local communities, and then there's a local match. The size of the match depends on the size of the community. Again, this is wandering off into the capital budget a little bit, but we're not asking for any new money. We're just looking for a reappropriation. There are some money that for projects that were completed, and there was some money left over. Then on the loan side of that program, we get money each year from the federal government. This has been going on for many years. It happens all over the United States. That money is taken in by states, and then they loan that out at favorable rates to communities, and that's where a large portion of the funding comes from for water and sewer plants around the United States. And then a portion of that is allowed to be forgiven. In fact, it's required to be forgiven under federal law. So each year you'll see a small capital request in our budget for that forgiveness portion. With the municipal grant and loan program shrinking, and perhaps, I hope not, but if it does go away, the question in our minds, will there be a gap in funding for communities around the state for water and sewer projects? That's one thing we're looking at, in our water program, this Stability Safe Water and this revolving loan fund program that we have, is that going to be enough to cover all needs in the state, or will there be a gap there? So those are the five divisions, and this takes us up to the fiscal year 2017 budget request. The total department operating budget's around $84 million. Of that, there's $17.7 million that's unrestricted general fund, which makes us the smallest department in terms of our UGF component. You'll see in this pie chart, the different sources of funding and their relative size to match the numbers that you see on the left. We get a fair amount of federal receipts, 28%, and then the large red piece of the pie is divided in half there. It's all designated general fund, that red. But you can see a little over half of that's the prevention account. That's about 19%. That's the money that we get from the 5-cent surcharge on crude oil production and the 0.95 cents per barrel on refined products. With the change in legislation last year, generated about $7.2 million, or is projected, I should say, projected to bring in $7.2 million. So you see our UGF component's only about 21%, of the pie. This next slide shows the differences among the five divisions in terms of their funding sources. And to me, this is, as a manager, this is a critical page. Because if you look, and we know we're looking at additional cuts, over time, we have to as a state. We're into this exercise for some time. But where do you look? And so in my mind, if it's going to be UGF cuts, you have to say, well, where does the UGF reside in the department? And so what you'll see on this chart, I'll start with spill prevention response, which is the second one from the right there, that bar. And if you accepted the governor's proposed fiscal year 17 operating budget for DEC, there will be no UGF left in SPAR. Right now, there's about 400,000 left in there, about 400,000. And that 400,000 relates to the last bit of UGF funding that goes to our pipeline corrosion and integrity program that was put in 2006. With the response fund being brought up to now where it's sustainable, we are proposing as part of our fiscal year 17 budget to do a fund switch there and get rid of the rest of that UGF that's in SPAR and fund those three corrosion engineers, with prevention account funds. The bar to the left of that is our air quality division, and you can see they have a relatively small amount of UGF in that division. Several reasons. One, of course, is a small division. But the other is its largest function is issuing permits under the Clean Air Act. And under the Federal Clean Air Act, the program has to be fee-supported. That's a federal requirement. And that you're able to do that in the air program because the permittees buy in larger facilities that have the capacity to pay larger permit fees. So that works. It works in that program, but it wouldn't work in others. Others, you'd need to have some kind of UGF subsidy. So the amount of UGF in the air quality program is basically, in my mind, federal match money. It's the minimum that you need to run an air quality department to have a permitting program, to attract the federal funds you see there, to run the authorized permitting program and collect the fees associated with those permits. It'd be really hard to get rid of any more UGF in air quality. And as I said, we've really leaned that division down already. I've driven it towards efficiencies, and so it is lean. To the far left, I'll jump over there to the Division of Administration. Their UGF component, it would be similar to any other division, I think, that you would look at in state government. Those are just the routine IT procurement and those type of services, nothing out of line there. So it really leaves you with just two divisions, the Environmental Health and Water Quality, where there's any quantity of UGF, that's really out there and still available, that $17.7 million, or I say available, I mean available for consideration. So going on to slide 13, the budget reduction scenario that we're all under at this point, it really started back in 2014, in my mind, at DEC, where we started looking at the declining oil production And it was really hitting us back then because we were seeing it in our spill prevention response division, which you remember was largely funded by the prevention account, which is at that time 5% surcharge on crude oil production. So as the crude oil production was going down, we saw our funding source disappearing. So even in fiscal year 2014, we gave up about $500,000 in designated general fund, which was the prevention account, so we could lower our draw on the prevention account and try to extend that. And we started developing criteria for additional cuts, and then these were in fiscal year 2015. We started discussing these with our House Finance Subcommittee, looking over these criteria and thinking about, well, how do we approach these cuts that we're going to need to make in a thoughtful, systematic way. And so that's what you see are these criteria right here, where we focus on preserving core services, those things that local government or the federal government can't take, you know, that are necessary to do, but nobody else can do them, really. No one else can step in. They're also looking at things that we have a really strong investment over the years in as a state, and if we gave those things up, we wouldn't get them back. You know, that we might not be able to get them back, build them back for 10, 20 years. I look at our large permitting programs, such as the air permitting program that we've had for over 30 years and our APDS program. If we gave those back to the federal government, one, I don't think they would be able to handle it because they're no longer set up to do those things. And second, by the time they ramped up over the next 5 to 10 years to do that work, you know, we would have been ramping down. We'd have lost all our experience with that. And if we wanted it back, it'd be another minimum 10, more like 20 years before we'd have those programs back and built up again. That's the kind of size of investment we have in them. So slide 14 just kind of recaps the budget situation looking over the last couple of years. Like I said, in fiscal year 14, we started that tightening in SPAR, and then we fiscal year 15 took some additional reductions, $1.4 million in our water division. You may recall the state was looking at perhaps taking the Clean Water Act 404 program, and then the decision back then by the legislature was, no, we're not going to continue that effort. And so we gave up five positions there at $1.4 million in fiscal year 2015. And, of course, when we got to and we also, at that point in time, again, seeing these cuts coming, if you look back, you'd see that we started taking there were much higher vacancy rates in, for instance, water and SPAR, where we knew that there were going to be reductions. So rather than just keep filling positions as they became vacant, we purposely left them open there, knowing that we wouldn't be able to afford those anymore pretty soon, so we didn't actually have to lay off people. Because I hear some discussion sometimes in the building and outside the building, well, those aren't real reductions, you know, they didn't fire anybody, there's no dead bodies. And I sit there and think, well, the reason you don't see them is because we started holding those positions vacant, so we didn't have to fire somebody, you know, and that gave us more flexibility of managing the situation. So that was what already happening going all the way back to fiscal year 2014. 2016, of course, is when we started getting the legislature's mandated cuts, and we reduced UGF by 10.6% in 2016. As you'll see here in a minute, in fiscal year 2017, our proposal would reduce UGF by another 11.8%.
That's correct.
Yeah, 11.8%. So if you put all those together, if you combined the decline in DGF and the other things that we took down the line, and we'd be around 25%. Now, granted, it's not all UGF, but that's where we've been heading for some time. The fiscal year 2016 cuts, these are just listed here. In addition to the cuts that we got in the budget that the legislature passed, our water division, again, was at a point where we just couldn't sustain 10 positions that were authorized, and we gave those up, you know, through management plan. And then, of course, there was the unallocated in 2016 that we also had to absorb. So that's why we ended up with a fair number of cuts in fiscal year 2016. So going forward, we're now into planning for fiscal year 2017. And again, the proposed budget will reduce UGF by another 11.8%. Besides the actual cuts, we're continually looking at efficiencies and reorganizations. Like I say, we're consolidating some programs. We're eliminating a program in the 2017 budget, albeit a relatively small program. We're also engaged in looking at trying to combine lease space. That won't happen, I don't think. Probably not until fiscal year 2018, but in our Anchorage office, we're looking at combining everybody into our Cordova building. We're also looking at our fees, and as you probably recall, and we're going to get into this, I think, during our subcommittee, a specific discussion on fees, is that we have two statutes that authorize DEC to collect fees for services, and they were restricted in several ways. One is we're basically only allowed to recoup some of our direct costs, but not our indirect costs, and then there's also I guess subsidies required, if you will, for certain smaller companies and that sort of thing, like we can't charge them for travel out to their facility and that sort of thing. And so when we're looking at fees here and changing fees, it's within those statutory confines. You know, we're just not free to go out and, you know, increase our fees on people. And we have to do it through a fee study. So what happens is periodically, and the statute provides how often we may go out and revisit our fees and look at increasing those to cover more of our direct costs. Tom's Division of Administrative Services, they look through all of the data, and it has to be data-driven, and then the statutory requirements, and decide whether there's a justification to increase the fee. And if it is, then we go through a regulatory process notifying the public and then go through that and set it by regulation. We just got through doing that in our air quality division, and we're looking at implementing a fairly modest fee increase there that would be effective by the start of the next fiscal year. And we're just starting fee studies in the water and in the food safety? Food safety programs. Like I say, I already gave you a little bit of preview of 2018. We're still looking, going on the same path. I don't see this changing for a while. You know, we're going to keep looking for efficiencies and consolidations and lease space and everything else to try to reduce our draw on UGF. Now I'm going to quickly go through the actual proposed reductions for fiscal year 2017. The first one, this is in our air quality division. It would be elimination of a shared it's in our Fairbanks office. It's not air quality. It's shared position. It's in our Fairbanks office. This is somebody at the front desk that was shared by a number of different divisions, and that position would be going away. The second one, this is basically a fee switch where we're able to take incoming fees and replace those and replace UGF with those for some laboratory services from our lab out on Tudor Road in Anchorage. The third one is in our air quality division, and this is kind of a two-phase thing. It's where we're taking an environmental program specialist position and reclassifying that as a chemist, which is a lower-paid position, and then we're also then looking at several people that retired and taking their work and moving those to lower-pay positions.
Commissioner, your
yes.
Voice tends to fall off when you're finishing off a
sentence. Okay, yeah, I'll keep in front of the mic here. Thank you. Thanks. Appreciate that. So in spill prevention and response, I already mentioned this. This is the last of the UGF in our SPAR division, and moving those two corrosion engineers from UGF over to the response fund money, the DGF. The next one is the dissolution of the technical services program in water quality. That program provided public outreach. Oversaw the preparation of new regulation packages for the Water Quality Division and managed the IT people. Those services now are just going to be absorbed elsewhere in the Division of Water, and then those positions that were in the technical service program would go away. That six PCNs and about 700,000 UGF. The next one in the Water Quality Program, this is the fee study that I talked about and the projected additional DGF that would generate. The next one is the reduction in our, this is in the water division again, and this is reducing UGF by moving those services to be paid out of some federal receipts that we identified that could replace those in one of our programs. The next one, this is a work in progress. This is, remember, the unallocated cut that came in for 2016 and now will be for also for fiscal year 2017. Originally, we were waiting on the results of, the labor negotiations to see whether that could produce enough savings to absorb that unallocated cut. But the timing of that isn't such that we can wait for that, and so we've been directed to go ahead and identify the exact cuts that will be taken if we don't realize the savings out of those negotiations that we need to absorb that unallocated cut. So for DEC, that would amount to four additional PCNs that we'd have to eliminate. And we'll, within the next 30 days, we'll have identified those positions. And this just is a table showing the summary of the of these changes, moving the UGF from about $20 million, that's where we are today in the current budget, to $17.7 million in next year's fiscal year 17 budget under the proposed operating budget. This is a slide we started putting in a couple years ago. It just gives you the order of scale. If you look at what Alaskans are getting for their money, it costs about 38 cents per day if that was being paid by the workers in the state. If you look at everybody in the state, it's about 17 cents a day for the services that that DEC provides. Page 21, this again goes back to my point that if you're looking at, well, where would you find cuts within DEC? Yes, where is the UGF? And this kind of reiterates how we spend our UGF money in DEC. $5 million of that 17.7, so that we can get our state match for federal grants. Some of it goes to the Environmental Health Lab. Some goes to admin services in Tom's division. Some supports the commissioner's office. And about half of it is to subsidize fee-based programs and to just take care of the odds and ends, like community complaints and working with communities on capacity building and those sort of things. But the thing to realize that within DEC is that some programs can carry themselves and some can't. There's some growing industries in Alaska, some industries that are just not of a scale, you know, that they can support the program to give them the permits they need to operate. This next page, 22, this slide, it just lists our federally delegated programs and then shows those programs that are not federally required. I'll go to the ones that are not federally required, since I've already talked about, I think, the federally delegated programs in sufficient detail. But these things are things that in some states might be handled by the local government, you know, whether it's the county government or the municipality. Things like restaurant inspections. Right now, Anchorage is the only one that does restaurant inspections. Juneau and Fairbanks don't do their own, so they expect DEC to do those. That's unusual. In most states, the state government really isn't involved in restaurant inspections. Here in Alaska, we have to pick that up because, as you can imagine, that rural Alaska, there's just not enough size there to run those kind of programs themselves. And so what we do is when we send an inspector out, you know, like say to Nome to inspect the fish processing plant, that inspector can then, while they're out there, go look at the restaurants and go look at the school. They can go look at the other food establishments, and Nome doesn't have to establish one. But those are the kind of things that we subsidize. So this gives you the history by PCN count for DEC, and it kind of just graphically shows what we've been talking about. In fiscal year 17, in the proposed budget, we'd be down to 518 PCNs. And if you look across fiscal year 2007, that puts us just about where we were 10 years ago in terms of PCN count. You can see how fast it dropped between fiscal year 15 and 16 when we took a lot of those cuts that I talked about.
This is just a summary of the unallocated reductions that we took in 2016. The bulk of it, again, was the two pipeline integrity engineering, or two engineers in that program, and some of the fund switch, and then just some efficiencies in admin services and air quality. We may be looking at a fiscal year 2016 supplemental just because we're alerted that we might be able to get some additional federal Diesel Emission Reduction Act grants money. If that does come in, that would just pretty much flow through DEC and go out to the community for some new diesel generators that are needed. And so you may see that request. And these requests coming in, this money coming into air quality, it's a bit unpredictable. It goes, bounces a bit up and down. So we're looking at maybe asking for an increment, $250,000 federal authority increase just going forward to be able to absorb those changes, not to come back year to year. On slide 26, we're getting into the performance measures. We have just a couple here that we're showing. The first one just shows how, if we're staying pretty much up to date on the permits that we issue. Most permits that we issue, at least the ones under federal law and most of the ones under state law, they have a five-year life to them. You know, we have to reissue them every 5 years. And that's important because a lot of these facilities, they'll change their operations in ways that they'll need to modify their permits. And so there's a regular five-year cycle. So we're keeping up on that pretty well, you can see. Even with some of the cuts that we've been absorbing, we've been able to largely meet that demand. The next one below it, this is home served with safe water, really safe water program. And it took a dip there, you can see, for a while, and there's a couple reasons. And probably the biggest reason is just that there's a different way now of accounting here, and so I don't know how real, you know, that dip is. But also there was a little bit of a hiatus there where we were slowing down taking on new projects where we were looking at, is there a better way of spending that money to make it more sustainable? And so there was a pause there while we were, you know, looking through the programs and what we were funding and whether that was sustainable. So I'm through that first half hour. If you want, we could go into some of the other graphs, or we could open it up for questions, Mr. Chairman.
That's fine, Commissioner. We can go to questions. I think we've all got Ledge Finance's information. If members have questions on that, we'll go back to them. First, I would like to recognize we have been joined by Representative Tilton. If you're watching to see what's going on with DEC, making sure that the air quality here is good.
Good.
Thank you, Representative Tilton. We have Representative Guerra followed by Representative Pruitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, so 11% cuts this year, 10.8% cuts last year, I think 5% cuts the year before, and I'm just wondering what's going to be left of your agency. So let me ask you a couple areas that I'm concerned about. Governor Palin, after the BP spill on the North Slope a number of years ago, started a pipeline safety and integrity office. And obviously the goal was to make sure we prevented another spill like that up on the North Slope. So how effective do you think that agency is at your current level of staffing at this point, that office? And what's the level of staffing now compared to when it was up and running at first?
Thank you, Representative Guerra, through the chair. In 2006, there were two pipeline spills on the North Slope from BP's facilities, and those were from what we call three-phase pipelines. These are the pipelines that run from the wellhead, the manifold there, to the processing center where they remove the gas and the water and to get the oil ready to send over to Pump Station 1 so that can be sent down to Valdez. And these pipes, they were older, they're smaller so that they're not piggable, and they're often clustered, so they're hard to observe, you know, any kind of corrosion. And so, and they're not regulated by the federal government, and at that point in time, there was no state in the country that was regulating those kind of pipelines. So it was something that was totally new. And so what we did at DEC, we put regulations in place relating to a corrosion program that industry would have to maintain. And then the legislature also gave us five PCNs, and I think it was about $600,000, if I remember right, $600,000 in our base budget for a pipeline corrosion integrity program. And we did a risk assessment with some outside consultants looking at what this should look like. And we hired the five engineers, and we developed this inspection program. And then over the last few years, as industry developed their program, and we were out doing field inspections, and we were also doing a lot of records inspection and review of their corrosion maintenance program for these three-phase lines, it started looking like we were duplicating things in some areas. And so we looked at some efficiencies and decided that we could let two of the engineers go, you know, without affecting the performance of the program. So I'd say it's kind of like, and I'm doing the same thing at Ocean Ranger right now. You know, how do you build a new program that hasn't ever been there before, and then you go back and look at it, is there a way of running this in a way that's more efficient with still achieving good results? So I feel comfortable, you know, that we're not giving up or not creating any more risk, you know, by letting those two engineers go, just because of the way the program's designed and it's up and running now. It's turned into a program more of us reviewing their program rather than us operating a side-by-side program and trying to do field inspections.
One other question, Mr. Chair. Thank you. So for a number of years, you know, before these last 3 years of cuts, when I say 3 years, I mean the governor's proposal for the third year. We've heard from Ms. Ryan that DEC's food inspection program is not at a level where the public can feel safe that food inspections are being conducted to prevent illness by people who go to restaurants and the places you regulate. That it was already at a level that I think she had referred to as not really a particularly safe level. How would you describe that program at this point?
Yeah, Representative Guerra, again through the chair. What I think Kristen Ryan was referring to, and Kristen was the environmental health director for 10 years before she moved over to SPAR, and I remember those statements when she was over at environmental health. And those were largely based on federal guidelines that are there for the frequency of inspections of what they call high-risk and lower-risk facilities. And if you look at that, Alaska's always been below that level. And so we would come to the legislature, and this goes back 5+ years, and say that, you know, we're behind where USDA says we should be in terms of the number of inspections of these different facilities. But if we were going to try to come up to that level, as I remember, it was something like $30 million. It was some number that was out of reach. No, it's 30 more positions. It would take 30 more PCNs based on what we had before to get up there. So it didn't look likely that we were going to get there, particularly with declining oil production. So what we started doing is looking at, can we concentrate just on the higher risk type facilities and then try to look at other ways besides inspections to deal with the lower risk inspection or lower risk facilities. So on the higher risk facilities, we're still out there. Yeah, but we're on the lower risk type of operations, we have either changed our regulations and say we don't regulate there anymore, or we're just not out there as frequency, with the same frequency. So my short answer is yes, there is more risk to the public now than there was before, but we try to do it in a way that we still hit those higher risks where they are. And one way we approach it is on food safety. The lower risk would be things where there's not a lot of processing going on the food, like ready to sell packaged food that you would get from a vendor on the, like, downstairs. Yeah. Or you would get, it would be, you know, bake sales and those kind of things, where if you run into a problem and you get sick, you know who to go to immediately. You can, and then you can stop it. You know, you can find out quickly where the problem lies and fix it. The higher risks are ones where there's a lot of food processing going on and mass distribution, where unless you really track it and something goes wrong, you have no idea who's eating that and how to stop it and where to fix it. And so we're concentrating on the higher risk now, and And communities, if they want to, they could step in and try to do something in those lower risk situations, but I don't think they'll have the capacity to do it. So it really gets out that point out to more public outreach, and we've been trying to do that, educate the public on what steps they can do to lower food risks.
Finally, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Guerra. And Commissioner, can we ask you to keep your answers a little bit more direct?
Yeah, and just finally, would you consider it to be a program that's adequately protecting public safety, and B, what are you going to inform people of how to, what are you going to inform people of, I guess? You said you're going to inform the public how to protect themselves.
Well, it's simple things, and keep my answer short. It would be things like, keeping, when you put food out, if it needs to be kept cold, keeping it cold. If it needs to be kept a certain temperature, higher temperature, keep it warmer, and washing your hands before you serve food. Basic things that have surprisingly good results.
And so does the program protect public safety adequately in your view?
I would like to do more in my view, but I think that on the higher risk things that we're doing a good job, but I think we have to be vigilant, and I think that we have to keep pushing out the information to the public and rely on them and communities more on those lower risk situations.
Just like many departments and the divisions within them, when we have a lot less money coming into this state, we're just going to have to try and do less. Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, thank you. I'm actually going to ask a question that I think Representative Gaddis has been asking, but I want to ask a little bit more detail, I think. I want to talk about your positions. If you go back to that slide, from FY15 to FY16, how many, with the decrease there, how many of the decrease was vacancy? How many were vacant positions?
I'd have to get you, Representative Pruitt, to the chair. I'll have to get you that number unless you know it, Tom, off the top of your head.
I missed the first part of your question, if you could.
Between 15 and 16, the decrease there, how many were vacant positions that we eliminated? How many vacant PCNs did we eliminate?
Through the chair, we eliminated about 25 positions, net 24 positions through the budget process. Out of that, 15 of them were vacant. There were about 10 positions where we had people in it. But to go a little bit further, like Commissioner Hardik said earlier, we knew that we'll have to lay off staff. So we've been holding positions vacant for a number of months. So by the time we were ready to we started the fiscal year, we had about 15 vacant positions and 10 filled positions.
Okay. Can I expand? So, and you may have to come back to me on this. So what was your vacancy percentage in 15, and what was your vacancy percentage in 16?
Through the chair, in FY15, we had about 13 to 15% vacancy rate. In FY16 now, we have about a little over 8% vacancy. If I could add one more thing, in our budget, there is a built-in vacancy of 7%. So we have a little extra, a little more than the budget vacancy, but we'll still have to maintain to live within the budget.
Okay, and continue. I'm assuming based on that last piece that the 17 is around that 8, maintained at that 8% vacancy around that.
Through the chair, yes, we will have to maintain around 7 to 8% to live within the budget even in 17.
Okay. So that I can get a, Mr. Chair, so I can get an apples-to-apples comparison, because we keep seeing slides and keep hearing that 17 and 7 are about the same. You're not the only department. We're hearing this from every department. What was your vacancy factor in 7? Are we truly looking at an apples-to-apples comparison of the department in this budget to what we had in 07? And I think that's probably, and that's, I'm asking it now because it's, I haven't asked it previously, but I think it's something that should be asked of everyone. So I want to make sure you guys understand I'm not picking on you. I'm just trying to make sure that we have a good apples to apples comparison.
Through the chair, again, we have to maintain a vacancy rate of 7%. So it is an apple to apple comparison, but because we did not have general fund, we end up laying off about 47 positions between 15 and 17. Again, out of the 47, 7 positions will be deleted in 17, and the 40 between 15 and 16.
Maybe I might need to re-ask that then. Thank you. I appreciate that. I'm interested in what the vacancy factor was in 07. You might not have that. I get that. And I understand that, if you could get that back to us. Because if it was, it helps me understand, if we had a vacancy factor in 15, then we were increasing along, we increased and maintained that. If it truly was at a 7-8% like we are now, then it shows that I think it's a true apples to apples at that point in time. If it was at 15%, then I think it shows that we're not on the same level that we were on 17. And that's for every department. I want to make that very clear. I think that's a discussion we can have for every department. So if you don't have the 07's numbers, I understand, but if you wouldn't mind looking into that and get back to me on it.
Through the chair, I don't have that information right now, so yeah. We'll get back to you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Cossack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple questions and then a clarification on the a question on for the restaurant and facilities inspections that you do. We mentioned this yesterday when the troopers were here too, but in municipalities, I guess Anchorage is the only one that does it. Fairbanks used to do it, and the reason why we quit ours was to save money, and because DEC was already doing it in some cases, and so we had to find some cuts, and that was one thing that went back in the late 90s. So with that said, do you do restaurant inspections in Anchorage, or does Anchorage do all of the ones for the municipal area?
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, I believe they do all of them. I'll check on that and confirm it, but I don't recall us doing inspections of restaurants in Anchorage.
Okay. And then, thank you, Mr. Chair. On the SPAR, the change that happened to SPAR last year, when the bill went into effect, I know I got billed for it because I got heating oil in the fall, and it's on there. Sure enough, I can't even remember what it says. I think it says spill prevention fund. So it's on your oil bill for our Fairbanks guys up here. I guess, so is it making as much money as we thought it was going to make under the fiscal note is my first question.
Yeah, Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, we're not through a full year of collecting that. The projection was about $7.2 million that would be collected in the response fund, and I think that would be both from the 0.95% on refined and the 5 cents per barrel. So we'd have to get that broken, get the Department of Revenue and break that out for you. But I think the projections are about as what we had anticipated. Going forward, I'm not quite sure whether we're going to be able to collect as much on the refined products as we thought, but we'll get that for you. But nothing major different at this point.
Okay. And then follow up, and then just one question about that. Then I can't remember when we passed our budget, it had that already in place, because we had UGF. We had to have UGF last year. Will we see money come back from the FY16 budget because that bill got passed?
No.
I'm not sure I understood the question. Sorry.
I was wondering if we had double booked it. We had budgeted for the UGF, and then along with that, then we passed a bill that basically would fund it. So I was just wondering if the UGF request from FY16 budget is still in there, or if you didn't need it. I just thought there'd be money coming back, but maybe it was...
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, and I apologize if I don't answer this question right, but I believe, and again, this is projected, we don't know yet, there may be a surplus of about $200,000, I'm guessing at this point, of amount that's collected in the prevention account that would be both related to this the crude oil surcharge and the refined product.
0.95 cents a gallon. But that was intended because the prevention account, of course, has to be appropriated every year by the legislature, you know, so it's always subject to appropriation. But it was intended to collect a little extra for the first couple of years because with the declining crude oil projection, then as the crude oil goes down, the idea was that the refined product use would continue to go up a little bit. That, with a little bit of surplus cushion, would then allow the prevention account to be sustainable for about a 10-year outlook, is I think what was the plan. So there was built into it that it would have a little bit of a excess in the first couple of years.
Okay, and just one other clarification. Thank you, Mr. Chair. On slide 15, when you were talking about some of the fees and better alignment of existing fees, maybe I misheard it, but the fees that you have or the fees that we have in within DEC's control, they're not statutorily set.
Representative, through the chair. By statute, we have to be authorized to impose a fee, and then the statutes say what the criteria are and the limits of the fee that we can set.
Okay. Okay.
The actual number, percentage, or something like that isn't set in there.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. And members, just out of absolute respect for the thousands of Alaskans that listen in and try and learn more about their budget, particularly in the times that we're in, you know, addressing questions through the chair helps people understand who's asking those questions and how they go about. So if we could just respect the people that are trying to make sure that they're paying attention, we'd appreciate that. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And hopefully we'll be on gas soon and we won't be paying a tax on our heating oil. Sorry I had to say that. First of all, some of these questions, maybe you'll just have to get back to us. But one thing I hear a lot is that DEC has more stringent regulations than the federal government does. I'd really like to know if we do, in mostly in water permitting, I've heard, especially when we talk about the mining industry. If that's true, if so, what areas that those are? I didn't think that's probably something you could just answer right now, but if you could just check on that, or whether you've gone through regulations lately to see which regulations that we might have that are more stringent than what the federal government requires. Yeah. I have another question, Mr. Chair. So on page 12, it was very helpful to see the UGF with the federal. First of all, what did you say other was? What funds those were?
They're on the pie chart on page 11, that purple area. I think that's what you're referring to, Representative Wilson.
Okay.
Yeah, and through the chair, that would be the Clean Air Protection Fund. Of course, the CIP would be operating money associated with the CIP project, interagency receipts, safe drinking?
SDPR.
Yeah.
It's a statutorily designated program.
Yeah, that would be our program receipts. Alaska Clean Water Fund, Alaska Drinking Water Fund.
That's very helpful. Follow-up, sir?
Representative Wilson.
So within that, still on page 12 then, how much, you know, if that was a breakdown on how much UGF was required for the federal funds and what you still then were to have left over, I know you said most of it was, but I don't know if that's all or what, you know, what the number would be. So just if you would just look at environmental health, how much of that UGF, that was actually a number that said what we were matching the federal funds with, and then what was left over that was not matching funds?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, in environmental health, I think the bulk of that UGF money, and we can get this for you, would be related to the drinking water program and to a lesser extent solid waste. The federal government periodically they issue what they call drinking water rules, which are applicable to public drinking water systems. And there are national rules that have to be followed by the people that run those drinking water systems to make sure that the public is safe from various different contaminants. And so DEC, when one of these federal rules comes in the past, but not recently, but in the past, DEC would come to the legislature and say, well, we need to get primacy of this federal rule. We need these funds to implement that rule in Alaska to help communities meet that rule. And if we didn't do that, then what would happen is the federal funds that come into the state, the grant funds that come in for those water projects would be cut off. because unless you have primacy of the drinking water rules, you don't get the federal funding that comes in for those projects. But we could get you the detail of that. I can't remember the exact, do you remember, Tom? Yeah, the exact amount. But it's significant, the amount of federal funds that would be lost. So it's not exactly matched, but it's kind of like the air program. If you don't do it, then you don't get the federal money. I don't know if that answers your question, Representative Wilson.
Yeah, yes, Mr. Chair, it does answer my question. I'm trying to figure out how much we're required to do and even why we took primacy of some of those. I know we got extra federal funds at one time, but I know some of those have dwindled off, and now we're kind of left holding the bag, basically saying we have to bring everything to a certain level, and there's many communities that would need a tremendous amount of money to be able to do that. So I'm just trying to understand what we absolutely have to do and what – and why we chose maybe to do other programs like you just said. And I have one final question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wilson.
So on page 22, when you were talking about the programs not federally required but essential to help public health, first of all, I just want to say thank you on the farmers market. I know you did some, you lessened up some regulations. Last year we put up signs instead telling people about what the safe ways of doing that. That has been very helpful. Hopefully you'll go down that line a little bit more. But I'd like to understand just more, and again, it's just more detail, if you could, on how much of each of these, you know, how much money are we paying to do that? So we can kind of have a better idea, a little more like when you say solid waste, what exactly, just a brief of what that is, and then how much, you know, general funds is going into that. Mm-hmm. So as we keep, you know, having to look at things, we know what kind of choice that we're making versus just assuming, you know, what the department does on each one of those would be very helpful.
Thank you. Representative Gaddis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I like my colleague across the way about PCNs and how many people were not in the department, actual people. And I think the other day I said how many bodies, and we all laughed about that. But seriously, as I think the public sees many state employees not being here, being honest is really what we want to come out, and I commend you for your honesty. I think another place where I'm going, and this is where I want to commend you, is where you're taking a higher paid staff and actually recognizing that you're taking that position and you literally lowered it to a more entry level position. And as I go through my budget, we talk about the people that we let go, but we have not, and I'm asking my colleagues to take a second look. We look at those ranges that aren't actually being brought down. So it's twofold. So thank you for bringing that forward, you know, so we can take a better look. But, you know, sometimes if you have those ranges, as you felt well know, that could be worth two people as far as the money that we pay out. So it's bigger than just one position, it's how much that position was worth. So I commend you on hiring somebody at a lower, or at least holding it open, knowing that that's the right thing to do and cutting costs. So thank you.
Thank you.
All right, any further questions from the committee? Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
That will take a very brief at ease, 30 seconds or so until we bring our next department. In fact, where is our Department of Labor? Eddies. Thank you. Let's bring the Finance Committee back to order. With us, we now have the Department of Labor and Workforce Development with Commissioner Heidi Digrass. Commissioner.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Heidi Dragas. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Before I launch into our department overview, I just want to take a moment. I've been watching some of these on gavel to gavel, and I think I understand now more than I did last year. Last year was my first go-around with this, how much work this is, of course, for our side, but also the work that you guys put into this, and how many budgets you have to go through and sit here for hours. And I know we are just one of many departments, but I just wanted to thank you for the effort that you put into it, the thoughtfulness, the questions that you ask. I've just been really impressed with the work of this committee, and I just wanted to acknowledge that. So thank you very much. We'll move on, and we'll jump right into it. So thank you for inviting us here today to talk about an overview of the department's fiscal year 2017 budget. The mission of the department, it's important to know the mission when reviewing our budget. The department's mission is to protect workers and advance opportunities for employment. The department accomplishes this mission through its key program priorities of protecting Alaska's workers through statutory assistance and enforcement, developing an Alaskan workforce for Alaska's jobs, and income replacement for injured, unemployed, or disabled Alaskan workers. A lot of you have seen our organizational chart before. This organizes our department by key priority program. The Division of Employment and Training Services and the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation both have sections that cross priority program lines. We've indicated that accordingly on the chart. Now we're going to go talk about quickly about some of the accomplishments for each priority program, excuse me, and dive into the budget details. Under our the area of protecting workers, we've continued to provide workplace safety consultation and enforcement, which keeps workers safe and reduces workers' compensation costs. These efforts resulted in the second lowest workplace lost time and injury rate on record in fiscal year 2015 at 0.89 per 100 employees, and we're proud of that effort. Recently, I requested information from the state's Risk Management Division about the rate of workplace injuries for state employees, and I was pretty alarmed by what I learned. In fiscal year 2014, the state spent over $27 million on workers' compensation claims and $28 million in fiscal year 2013. That's state of Alaska employees. So I sent a letter to each commissioner recently offering occupational safety and health consultation to lower the incidence of workplace injuries and thus the associated costs to the state. We're also taking on worker misclassification. The department's workers' compensation, occupational safety and health, unemployment insurance, and wage and hour staff continue to implement reforms to crack down on worker misclassification, including a multi-departmental MOU establishing a working group. These achievements translate into higher wages and greater income security for Alaska's workers. So diving into the budget detail that you requested, the Alaska Labor Relations Agency under the Commissioner of Administrative Services, it has a minimal number of staff to facilitate the resolution of disputes between organized labor and public employers. Within the Labor Standards and Safety Division, the Wage and Hour Administration allocation provides consultation and enforcement of Alaska's wage and hour, Alaska hire, and child labor laws. Each year, the program generates more money for the state than it costs to operate, which is important to note. This revenue is deposited directly into the unrestricted general fund, and then the UGF pays for the program. It would take a statutory change to put this money into a separate account. The mechanical inspection allocation conducts inspections to protect workers by ensuring electrical, mechanical, boiler, pressure vessel, and other similar code compliance. The costs of this program are covered by fee-for-service revenue that is deposited into a designated general fund account, and then that account pays for the program. The occupational safety and health allocation provides consultation and enforcement for occupational safety and health. The unrestricted general funds that support this program provide state match to federal funds. And the Alaska Safety Advisory Council organizes the annual Governor's Safety and Health Conference, which happens in March. The program is fully funded by the revenue they generate from sponsorships and attendance fees. Jumping right into workforce development. In the area of workforce development, 88% of AVTECs, Alaska Vocational and Technical Center's long-term, which is longer than 6 weeks, program students in fiscal year 2015 graduated. That's 341 of 387 students, which exceeded the target graduation rate of 80% set by the Council on Occupational Education's goal. They are the accrediting agency for AVTEC. And continuing on a healthy graduation rate trajectory. We also revamped the workforce development system by merging two divisions at the department into the Division of Employment and Training Services. The merger resulted in reduced staffing and greater administrative efficiencies, which allowed us to put more money out on the street as grants. Also, the resulting savings addressed $337,000 of the department's fiscal year 2016 unallocated reduction. Meanwhile, the Division of Employment and Training staff won two highly competitive federal grants that support registered apprenticeship. With this funding, the department will help build the state's healthcare workforce through apprenticeships and the new 4 to 6 weeks pre-apprenticeship programs at AVTEC. These new programs will help meet the high demand for entry-level healthcare occupations. So now the budget program detail. With a minimal level of staffing support, the Alaska Workforce Investment Board, AWIB, which is a federally mandated board, provides policy oversight of state and federally funded job training and vocational education programs. The programs that AWIB oversees actually fund AWIB itself. Under Employment and Training Services there, the Workforce Services allocation administers Alaska's Job Center Network and Alaska's Online Job Bank. And just to note that we will not have to close any job centers in fiscal year 2017. The workforce development allocation comprises all of the department's workforce development grant programs, including the State Training and Employment Program, or STEP program, the Technical and Vocational Education Program, TVEP, pass-through grants to regional training centers. The Federally Funded Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act programs, or WIOA, and Unrestricted General Fund pass-through grants for programs like the Alaska Construction Academies. Under Vocational Rehabilitation, the Client Services Allocation assists Alaskans with disabilities to secure and maintain employment. The Special Projects Allocation you see there consists of a few federal grants with some state matching funds, and those provide employment services to individuals with the most significant disabilities to enter or retain employment, and to provide technology-related assistance for individuals with disabilities. And finally, the Alaska Vocational Technical Center provides vocational and technical training to prepare Alaskan residents for jobs. Moving along to the area of income replacement. The department saw an improvement in the timeliness of unemployment insurance claim payments, with 94.3% of claims paid within 21 days versus 91.7% in the prior year. UI claims continue to be processed at a rate that exceeds the federal benchmark of 87%. Now for the program detail. The Division of Workers' Compensation. It aids Alaskans with employment-related injuries by administering the Alaska Workers' Compensation Act, the Fisherman's Fund, the Workers' Compensation Benefits Guarantee Fund. Am I going too fast? Okay. No. Representative Wilson. Okay. All right. I'll keep going.
I'm kind of used to listening.
Okay. Good. Good. Okay, so the Division of Workers' Compensation aids Alaskans with employment-related injuries by administering the Alaska Workers' Compensation Act, the Fisherman's Fund, the Workers' Compensation Benefits Guarantee Fund, and the Second Injury Fund. The Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission is actually a separate division within the department, but it's listed under that for budgetary purposes. It adjudicates appeals from disputed Workers' Compensation Board decisions. Legislation has been introduced in both bodies to repeal that body and move those appeals back to the courts. Under Employment and Training Services, the unemployment insurance allocation pays benefits to eligible unemployed workers – and assesses and collects employer and employee contributions to the Unemployment Trust Fund, the State Training and Employment Program, and the Technical and Vocational Education Program. Under vocational rehabilitation, the disability determinations allocation provides timely adjudication of medical determinations for persons alleging a disability under the Social Security Act. Okay, moving right along. Now let's talk about the department's budget. Overall, the department's unrestricted general fund reduction in fiscal year 2016 totaled $7.6 million, or nearly 23% of the department's UGF in 1 year. This includes the department's share of the unallocated reduction totaling roughly $418,000. To accommodate these reductions, the department focused considerable efforts on reducing both administrative and overhead expenses. Here's where we allocated those reductions. The Commissioner's Office and Administrative Services eliminated 10 positions, including the department's communications coordinator, which was housed in the Commissioner's Office, at a reduction of $600,000. We also put considerable efforts into lease consolidation. We have been moving a lot at the Department of Labor. Lease space has already been reduced in Juneau and Kenai, and those efforts helped address 81,000 of the department's fiscal year 2016 unallocated reduction. And right now we're focusing our efforts on Anchorage, and we see that we will experience a savings of about $100,000 in reduced lease costs. In 2017. We consolidated the Division of Business Partnerships and the Employment Security Divisions into one division, the Division of Employment and Training Services. This consolidation covered 337,000 of the department's fiscal year 2016 unallocated reduction. And as I mentioned previously, AvTech has refocused its allied health program away from long-term state-funded programs to short-term federally funded programs for high-demand entry-level healthcare occupations. Now to talk about our fiscal year 2017 budget. Our 2017 governor's budget totals $165.5 million, 52% of which is federal funds. The department's unrestricted general funds in the fiscal year 17 budget totals $23.9 million, which is down $1.9 million from the current year, fiscal year 16. The department has 806 employees. This is down 209 employees over the last 5 years, since 2012, which is an average reduction per year of 40 employees. Changes to the department's budget include reducing the amount of UGF supporting our lease costs by $100,000, reducing AvTech's reliance on UGF by nearly $75,000, and the department has proposed a regulation change to AvTech's tuition and fees in order to offset the UGF reductions and cover increasing operating costs at AvTech. And long-term program tuition hasn't seen an increase since 2010, so it's overdue. We're reducing the UGF supporting the Alaska Construction Academies by $600,000 in accordance with legislative intent. We're transferring the Independent Living Program to the Department of Health and Social Services, and there's a corresponding executive order to clean up the statutory references to the program within the Department of Labor. The department reflects the merger of the Business Partnerships and Employment Security Divisions into the Division of Employment and Training Services in the operating budget, and there is a corresponding executive order to clean up the statutory references to the Employment Security Division. We're reversing the fiscal year 2016 UGF salary adjustments in an unallocated lump sum of roughly $235,000. These plans could change depending on what actions the legislature takes, but this decrement will be spread across allocations the same way that the original salary adjustments were spread, result in reduced supply purchases, equipment replacement, and staff training, result in further staff reductions across the agency, which will have direct service implications. And we have a spreadsheet that reflects how this reduction is going to be spread, and we're going to be working with our subcommittee on that. So we've been asked to incorporate the following 10-year look-back slides provided by the Legislative Finance Division into our overview presentation. This chart shows the changes in the department's general fund budget since fiscal year 2007. It's important to note that in this context, general funds means both UGF and DGF. The department's designated general funds include the State Training and Employment Program, the Technical and Vocational Education Program, and revenue generated by fees for service. A majority of the department's increase since fiscal year 2007 has been in the designated general funds area. For example, STEP and TVEP increased $6.7 million due to legislative changes in Alaska's growing workforce. So here's another chart that I personally find a little bit confusing. What I think is worth noting in this chart is that while total personal services expenses increased by $6.1 million over this time frame, the department has actually experienced a loss of 231 employees from fiscal year 2007 to now. This is due, so this increase is due to wage and benefit adjustments, which include increasing health care benefit costs. This chart shows the department's budget, all funds by division. The big changes in fiscal year 2017 resulting from our division consolidation makes this chart a little bit confusing. So we prepared another chart which combines the two merged divisions over the entire time period that we think is makes a little more sense. So this is the chart that we produced. The federal funding within the Division of Employment and Training Services, which is the top line there, makes it by far the department's largest and most volatile division. The federal funding going into this division is cyclical. Funding levels are higher when unemployment is high. Unemployment is lower right now, so funding has likewise gone down. In fiscal year 2010, when Employment and Training Services funding was at its peak, the national unemployment rate was 10%, and Alaska's unemployment rate was 8%. And you can see that at the top of the chart there. Now, in fiscal year 2016, the national unemployment rate is 5%, and Alaska's unemployment rate is 6.5%. So thus, those funds have gone down. This chart shows the department's general funds by division. Again, general funds means unrestricted and designated general funds. And again, because of our division consolidation at the department, this chart is also a little hard to follow. So the department prepared another chart that combines the two merged divisions over that entire time period. So this is the chart that we produced. And the top line is, again, the Division of Employment and Training Services, which is our largest division. The decrease in the Division of Employment and Training Services that you see from fiscal year 2015 to fiscal year 2016, right there towards the end of the line, is primarily due to the elimination or significant reduction to the department's UGF-funded workforce development grants, such as reductions to the Alaska Construction Academy of over $800,000 and regional training centers of nearly $700,000, and elimination of the Alaska Youth First, Compass Alaska, Career and Technical Education, and Oil and Gas Training Funds at about $2.5 million. And now we have reached the end of our budget presentation. So I'm happy to entertain questions.
Commissioner, I'll start out with a couple. Go to page 9, please. Thank you, Commissioner. When we look at I see you. I'm glad you included the statutes on some of these other commissions and funds, undesignated funds. So when was the last time that those costs were determined and last reviewed?
I'll have Paloma take that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Paloma Harbor. I'm the Administrative Services Division Director for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Chair Newman, just in case I don't understand your question correctly, the workers' compensation program is funded by a fee on workers' compensation premiums, and that thank you. That percentage changes each year based on it's a relative percentage of the workers' compensation premiums.
I guess, Paloma, maybe to clarify the question, which one of these different compensations. I'll just say that one of these different five different funds. Does the legislature set the rate on that, or the different percentages on how those work, or how do those monies come in?
Okay, that's a great question. The second injury fund is based on actual incidents, and so it pays benefits based on the demand for the service. And then there's a fee that all the employers pay as part of their – it's a separate fee, actually, from their workers' comp premiums that all those employers contribute, and it's a self-sustaining fund, so the amount fluctuates based on the actual benefit payments. The Workers' Compensation Benefit Guarantee Fund is actually fines on employers that don't comply with the Workers' Compensation Act, and so those are – we generate that revenue by collecting those fines from those employers, and that pays benefits to the injured workers who didn't have workers' comp coverage and should have. The Fisherman's Fund Council, that revenue comes off of fishermen commercial licenses, and that percentage changes every so often. I'd have to get back to you on exactly how often. But again, benefit payments to actually injured fishermen. So the only program that has anything but benefit payments is that top line workers' compensation. And that is the program that administers the Workers' Comp Act, so they actually do investigations to ensure employers are compliant. And as I stated before, that's paid for by a percentage of the premiums. And I don't know that those have been looked at since 2006. I'd have to get to you the right year.
Commissioner, it's just in an effort to try and make sure that we have the funds available for the department to be able to do their jobs. We have less state funds coming in, and just going back and looking at different fees that you charge in that effort, you know, to try and maybe maybe you can make suggestions to the Budget Finance Subcommittee, work with Representative Wilson on that, if there's ways that need to be changed or can be changed if they haven't been looked at in a while.
We're happy to do that. And we have, Mr. Chair, we have continued to do that. I know we discussed some of this last year during the budget discussions, and we took that pretty seriously. So we'll continue to work on that.
Thank you. And then if we can go to page 10. And I just went down to where it says the AFTEC Allied programs refocused it from the state-funded long-term programs to federally-funded apprenticeship-type programs. What state-funded programs are we talking about? And
our allied health.
Are we funding them out? Explain that.
Sure. I apologize for talking over you. Mr. Chair, our allied health program previously was a very popular program at the Muldoon, located at the Muldoon campus for AVTEC. Was mainly consisted of registered nurses and licensed practical nurses. So it was RNs and LPNs. It was a very expensive program to run per pupil, and it was reliant heavily on state funds. There was also some private funding involved. But when that funding got cut, the private sector simply couldn't. I'm a loud talker. Sorry. simply couldn't pick up the slack for the diminishing state funds. So what we decided to do is, and one of our other concerns, and we discussed this in our subcommittee as well, we were also concerned with duplication because the University of Alaska Anchorage already has a terrific RN program, although there's a significant wait list. So we were concerned about that duplication. And what we decided to do is just revamp and refocus what AVTEC was doing. One thing we know that we need in the state of Alaska is we need more entry-level healthcare workers. And it's one of the areas where we have significant turnover in the state, and that impacts the quality of care for folks getting these services from healthcare workers. And so what we decided to do was revamp the Allied Health Program at AVTEC to focus instead on the RN and LPN programs that were very, very expensive and federally funded. And state funded, and we received some federal grants, and we decided to use those federal grants to help start up a healthcare apprenticeship and pre-apprenticeship program. And what we're focusing on is entry-level healthcare occupations. There's, I think, 9 or 10 of them Behavioral health aid is one of them. There's several others. And what it does is the pre-apprenticeship program exposes young people, exposes veterans that possibly are leaving a service. We're really focused on underemployed individuals. Exposes them to the healthcare field to see if something that they might want to do, and this can help to what we're hoping to is alleviate some of the turnover, because oftentimes you get somebody who just needs a job and they go into the healthcare field and it's not what they wanted to do at all. Well, this pre-apprenticeship program is much less expensive to administer. The seed money is basically from federal funds, and we want it to be self-sufficient, but it will get them exposed into the program so that they know whether they really want to do that kind of work or not. It's very, very difficult, strenuous work. And then from there, possibly transition into these apprenticeship programs. Providence Hospital already has some apprenticeship programs. There are other healthcare institutions that have apprenticeship programs. One thing they need is they needed more of a structure to have a place where the curriculum was there, so they didn't have to reinvent the wheel each employer. So we sort of created this consortium, or we're working to create this consortium to get this healthcare apprenticeship program off the ground. And so far it's coming together very well. I'm very impressed with the work that my staff is doing. And that will move these individual Alaskans through apprenticeship programs on a career pathway. So you start in an entry level, but you certainly don't stop there. There are plenty of places to advance beyond that entry-level behavioral health aid occupation, but it really is targeted to improve Alaska's healthcare workforce.
Thank you, Commissioner. And then just if you could follow up, just in an effort to try and I understand why you're doing the nursing program, and it's like myself, I never would have became a professional mechanic or woodworker if I hadn't been exposed to that in high school in doing that. And there's a tremendous amount of savings that goes to different businesses because people don't become employed, they train them into that position, and then they just realize it's just not their bag. You know, they don't enjoy doing that kind of work. So getting exposed to different trades is very important to reducing their costs. Is there an outreach by the department to reach out to companies and businesses to try and ask them to help fund some of these training programs?
Well, we have a lot of partners in this grant opportunity with this healthcare registered apprenticeship program. South Central Foundation is one of them. Several joint apprenticeship training committees are part of that program. We have Providence involved. We have several healthcare institutions that are involved in this grant program. And so this is a very collaborative effort. Right now, it is funded by this federal grant money. The grant is specifically dedicated toward this. But part of the reason that we want to do this, we don't want to have it federally funded and then the state has to continue funding it. We know that that doesn't work, and that's not going to work in this new world that we're living in with the budget here at the state of Alaska. So the idea is to have the seed money to get this consortium, this healthcare registered apprenticeship consortium, off the ground, and that's what we're working on right now. And then there will be funding mechanisms, whether employers will pay in to keep the funding program going, much like a joint apprenticeship training committee would do with registered apprenticeship program funding. And there's a healthy reception to that, and we're working right now on the details. But we're working on curriculum for these programs as we speak, and I believe we're going to try to roll out, actually get some instruction going on these classes in possibly March or April.
Commissioner, do you have an outreach effort? Several years ago, I worked on some legislation that was vocational education credits, where companies could receive credits from the state towards corporate income taxes if they donate money, give money to schools to help for vocational education. Could you kind of talk about that program so businesses that are around the state know what that is and they want to become more interested in that?
We, as far as I'm aware, we have received specific donations from companies. One of the ones that we just did a media press release last week, we got a donation from Superior Energy for $5 million worth of equipment. They're shutting down their offices in Anchorage. They are donating to Avtech a mission simulator, or marine simulator, sorry. and several pieces of equipment, computer equipment, instructional equipment, classroom desks. Just a remarkable, it couldn't come at a better time because we have a lot of aging computers and other items at AvTech, and now is not the time to put in a capital budget request, as you all know. So we're really, really pleased. We're going to use that to the greatest extent possible. I think we'll put every piece of equipment to work. We've received donations from SaltCheck in the amount of, I believe, $60,000. So we have received individual donations. Am I missing any? And there are others, and we would have to look at those. I like the idea of doing some innovative type of funding, perhaps giving a company a tax credit for employing registered apprenticeships. That's something that several states are looking at. I think there's a bill in Congress looking at that, but encouraging businesses to engage in registered apprenticeship. I think that's a very healthy economic model, and it's something I would be happy to look at in the future, if not this session. I think that's a great idea.
Mr. One of the pieces of legislation I worked on earlier, one of the earlier commissioners, Greg Bell, I think, what it did at that time, and it's been changed. Senator Myers had something that changed it, but it was you get a 50% credit on your corporate taxes for the first $100,000. If you were to, you could go right to a high school and give it to them, and get a 100% credit on the second $100,000. So you get $150,000 credit on a $200,000 donation, but. The trick in that, or the catch in that, was because it fell under federal tax code under defined public benefit, they were also eligible for another $69,000 in federal credits, so they could get $209,000 in credits, or $218,000 in credits on a $200,000 contribution into vocational education, going right directly to schools to teach them vocational trades that were representative of their industries. And it also allowed, I think for the first time, for them to receive endowments legally under state law, and it's one of those types of things I think we need to try and emphasize as much as we can to try and private industry to try and help out, mm-hmm. get more vocational education opportunities.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting concept. I'd be willing to look into that. I think what I like is actually even more than just a charitable donation from a company, from a business to a technical vocational program. I think, to me, it's almost more tangible to have some skin in the game and give them the tax credit when they actually show us some numbers, when they actually have utilized training programs, when they actually have registered apprentices on their books. I mean, we have terrific statistics about how registered apprenticeship improves the lives of individuals and grows a workforce in any state. And we think of apprenticeship as construction. And I went to a White House apprenticeship conference in September, and I was blown away by the models of apprenticeship. It's so beyond construction. It's in mining. It's in healthcare. It's in the insurance industry. I mean, there's these terrific models that they have in Europe that they utilize registered apprenticeship. This is your job. This is your career path, and it's not limited to construction at all. And so I mean that to me would be a great way to encourage the use of registered apprenticeship for any number of industries. What we're doing right now at the department is focusing on growing our healthcare workforce through registered apprenticeship, but we certainly don't plan to stop there.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Wilson.
I don't know why. I don't really have a question, Mr. Chair. I just want to let the rest know. First of all, I want to commend this department. They have found efficiencies. They have put things together. They have looked at the footprint of what they have for their rental. They came in a couple years ago with a really bad lease they kind of got stuck with. And since then, they have been the model of how we could still be efficient. But really in this department, besides matching funds, we have – they are grants, and we're asking what the grants are being used for, Mr. Chair. But it's through regional school grants that they give right now, AvTech, adult education, your GEDs coming back, and the construction academy. Pretty much everything else in this department is matching. And so when we start making the looks of this, we are talking about seeing whether or not some of these other schools that we've just been giving grants to because they were there from other legislative bodies, legislators, not bodies, I guess there's only one house, but not us, how we're trying to be much more efficient on utilizing the university as well as the department. And I see the department taking the lead, especially on these types of courses, to make sure that they are the lead on these, let the university be the academics, the bachelor's and associate's degrees, and I think that's how we find better programs, Mr. Chair. And I know you've been very concerned of those who might be out of work. This is the way that we keep them going, and I am so proud that they found federal funds to not just found the funds, but are going to start something we haven't done in a long time, and I think that's where you're going to see a big growth in this department, not just by asking for general funds, but actually going out and finding funds that fit their department. So no real question, but just glad I have this one.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, I'm looking on page 12 with the reduction of the Construction Academy, is that topic, by $600,000. I'd just be interested to invite you to expand a little bit on how that's affected the operation or the – didn't we try to retarget the intended audience of the Construction Academy students? Just to help you understand how that's affecting things.
We're going to continue to talk about the Alaska Construction Academies within our subcommittee. I think it's important. It's a large part of the department's budget. I do know that the Alaska Construction Academies worked hard to get to increase the donations that they get. They get donated space. They get donated trainers. They get donated instructors. They get donated equipment, and they had to rely on that more heavily, given the decrease in funding. I don't know if you want to. Do you want to speak more to that? No. Okay. All right. You can stay there, though. Yeah. Just in case there's any more. So yeah. I mean, I think it forced them to operate a lot more a lot leaner than they were before.
Thank you.
Representative Williams. Thank you, Commissioner. On that point, how does the funding work? Does it go toward secondary schools and post-secondary? Could you explain how the programs for the construction academies work, please?
It does. Yes, through the chair. I'm bad about that. I have to remember that. Through the chair, Representative Munoz. It does go to post-secondary adult education as well as high school students for exposure to the construction trades. As far as how the funding works, I'm going to have Paloma speak more specifically to that.
Thank you again for the record, Paloma Harbor with the Department of Labor, and through the chair, Representative Munoz. Okay. my numbers are a little bit old. I have FY14 actual information. I have not yet gotten the FY15 actual information. At that time, a third of the funding went toward adult training and two-thirds went to the secondary education. We did last year retarget, and we took the reduction, the majority of the $800,000 reduction that they got in FY16 at the secondary level, because that was kind of the direction we were given, focus on adults. And so now it's probably more half adult funding and half going to the schools.
Can I just follow up on that? Then will this cut, a reduction of $600,000, will that jeopardize any of the current programs?
Representative Munoz, through the chair, we don't know that yet. I think with the Alaska Construction Academies, it's a policy question. One of the things that we've talked about in our subcommittee is whether it is the purview of the Department of Labor to have funding that goes towards high school students that engage in construction, in construction training. My answer to that is absolutely yes. The department cannot fulfill its mission of training workers if we do not provide exposure to young Alaskans to the construction industry. It is vitally important. These schools are doing some of that. The construction academies are picking up a lot of that work. and really giving students an opportunity to try the trades. One thing that we do know is that we have an aging workforce in the construction industry, and we're going to have some significant problems heading into the future, especially as we look at building a gas line. We have worked on several presentations regarding our oil and gas workforce development plan, specifically targeted to gas line workforce development. And I am concerned that as we ratchet back funding, it's going to make the job of the department much more difficult, because we have to build up that workforce. It doesn't just happen. You go out there and you find the people. That's something you have to expose individuals to, especially at that age, and frankly, I would say younger, 7th, 8th grade, to really give them an idea of if it's something that they would want to do.
Thank you.
Representative. Thank you. Commissioner, the picture on the last slide of the presentation, maybe you could talk a little bit about what that is. Attempting to convey,
yes.
And if there are more opportunities like this with the Department of Corrections and maybe other correctional facilities.
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, Representative Edgman, I'm glad that you pointed that out. So these are some ladies that were incarcerated at Highland Mountain Correctional Center, and they engaged in a program of, I might have to have Paloma specifically speak to the program. We do a lot with Highland Correctional Center. There are some really terrific ladies at this facility, and it's something that we have been tasked with doing our part to reduce recidivism in Alaska. And as the governor continually says, when you have a job, you tend to commit less crimes. I think I'm paraphrasing, but That you have a job, you have something to do. You don't have idle time. You have self-worth. You have a purpose. You have a mission. And that is so much about what the department does, and reducing recidivism marries so well with the department's mission of putting people to work. And this is just one of our programs. We would love to expand programs like these. We also have a great collaboration with the Iron Workers Apprenticeship Program with Highland Mountain Correctional Center. And we would love to expand it. It's a matter of money and finding the funds to be able to do things like this. But this is the type of work, frankly, that really matters.
Can I just add a quick follow-up? So is the facility at Highland Mountain Correctional Center, is that that offers advantages for you to do something like this? And I bring it up because I think we heard that maybe it was our meeting with the Department of Corrections staff prior to having the subcommittee start up, but we heard some reference to maybe there might be some advantages to actually moving the inmates to the Palmer Correctional Facility.
Through the chair.
Maybe this is a discussion for another time, but I just offer that for any comments you might have at the moment.
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, it sounds like you're asking, whether structurally there's something better about Highland or Palmer, and I can't speak to that right now. One thing that I will say is one of the reasons that we are engaged with the incarcerated individuals at Highland is because they are women. And one of the things that we really are trying to do through several initiatives is to increase the number of women and minorities in the construction industry, as well as an apprenticeship. And so it's a natural fit.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Gare?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, can you go to page 18? Thanks. That was the only spot where I thought you were speaking too fast for me to take notes. You weren't speaking too fast just for me to take notes. So just on employment and training services, so the part where the Construction Academy fits in, obviously there's been a significant cut from FY15 to the governor's proposal, $5 million, from $23 million to $18 million, roughly. So I was taking notes on what was cut last year, and it was $800,000 from the Construction Training Academy, as I recall that.
It's 835.8 from the Alaska Construction Academy last year, and The regional training centers, there are three regional training centers that get UGF funds, and their funds were cut in half to 678.3.
Was ABE cut too?
Yeah, what was? And then also, we eliminated three other grant programs: the Alaska Youth First Compass Alaska program, CTE, and oil and gas training grants. Those were eliminated at $2.4 million. $2.4, $2.1.3 million.
Through the chair, so Youth First, was that 2 years ago or was that last year? That was last year?
2 years ago, it was cut in half and funded as a one-time item, and then last year was its last year.
Okay, so thank you, through the chair. A little slower. So the three grants that were cut last year, the remainder of Youth First, oil and gas training grants, and what was the third?
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, CTE.
Through the chair, what does CTE stand for again? Career and
Career and Technical Education.
And then through the chair, what was the total for those three grant cuts?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, the total was $2,421,300.
All right, and then through the chair.
Representative Guerra.
So now getting to the governor's plan. So we've got those cuts for last year. I understand the proposal to cut the construction training academies by another $600,000 for this coming year. Are there any other proposed cuts to training for this coming year? I just didn't see those. Or
no.
And thank you, through the chair. And then just so I can recall, on Youth First, how much was remaining last year that was then cut out?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, $1.4 million.
Right, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just because we were talking about the Construction Academy, would it be a benefit, instead of having a pass-through grant for just one industry, that it would be more structured toward a grant to ever-changing programs that might be necessary? I mean, there's nursing, there's restaurant, there's, I mean, if we start listing all the different things that you could be, that would fall underneath the Department of Labor, there's so much more than construction. And a lot of the construction is held by the unions, and they have apprenticeships, and they have a lot of things that they do. So in your opinion, as you've come through this, what would be the benefit of keeping it just on construction into a pass-through grant versus if we wanted to still keep money into training, that it would be more like the STEP program, the State Training Employment Program, in which there are measurements? It's a competitive grant to go to the ever-changing world of whatever, a gas line or maybe seafood all of a sudden, maybe a new mine would open up. Would that make more sense than just one industry in the state? Because right now we're just doing it to one industry versus a competitive type grant to where it could be better utilized for anything that was necessary at the time.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I think it's an interesting interesting issue you raise. I believe it's a policy question for this body. I believe what I think is good about the Alaska Construction Academies is that there is a structure in place for that, and there is a need for more construction workers in this state, especially as we gear up towards building one of the largest projects North America has ever seen. So I hesitate to say that this is a good time to take that money and move it somewhere else. That's not to say that mining, the mining industry and making sure we have workers in the mining industry isn't important, or in healthcare, or in in fisheries, in bringing down our non-resident rate of hire in the seafood processing industry. There are so many places where we need to focus, and we're taking one chunk at a time. So I hesitate before I say, yeah, we could do something else with it, or maybe we could use it as kind of a fund to kind of do all kinds of different programs. I would love that. I'd actually love more funding, and then we'll find good ways to use it. I don't see that. I don't anticipate that happening. But the Alaska Construction Academy model is a good one, and it is exposing individuals to the construction trades. And many of them from the construction academies, whether they are high school students being exposed to construction or whether they are adults getting training, go on to healthy careers in the construction industry, whether they go right out and get jobs with the construction industry or they go into one of the apprenticeship programs that are out there. So it's a terrific feeder for the construction industry that I would be remiss to cut off.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wilson.
Absolutely a good program. And if they were that good, they would be able to meet the competitive process of it. I am just very concerned, and it will be a policy decision that's made by the most likely the Finance Committee, of why we're favoring one group over all the other needs of the state. And that really is what we're doing. And it is a pass-through grant. It's very hard to make measurements with it. But even that put aside, is if it was competitive and they were able to meet the criteria, we wouldn't be stopped funding. We would just allow others to have that same opportunity. And that is the discussion that we'll be having subcommittee. And the other part of the policy call is it's not whether or not we want to expose our high school students to all different kinds of trades. Absolutely we do. However, Representative Gaddis has the Department of Education, and which is K through 12. The larger policy question is, does the Department of Labor continue to do what they're doing and they send a bill basically to the Department of Education or to the schools and they also partially pay because they do have CTE funding within the formula. So it's not really a question about whether or not we believe, Mr. Chair, that it should be within the high school. It really, at this time, becomes who pays, you know, and so we'll continue that in the subcommittee because that's going to be our mission to make sure first that we'll do, but it is a wider policy call, as I have seen in departments, especially even with the university, when one department can't get the money from their area, they'll go hope that somebody else in another department. Now we're at a point where I think we're really trying to restructure not the department itself only, but whether or not where does it belong on that. So I just want to make sure I'm not saying the Construction Academy is bad, Mr. Chair. It's just we basically are saying one is better than the other by the way we're funding. Now, that may be okay, but I think it's a wider question of seafood, mining, or some of the two biggest industries right now in which we bring people out of state for very, very high-paying jobs. And lastly, Mr. Chair, I hope everybody, if you didn't get your Department of Labor trends, I will make sure you have a copy of it. But in their construction is falling off because there isn't funding for it. It is not a large demand, as there are in some other areas right now in which our children are missing out on high-paying jobs. So I just, you know, it's just much bigger than just one program.
And
I guess that wasn't a question, sorry.
It's late today. It's okay. The jobs that will come from the gas line, or I hope come from the gas line, are not short-term time horizon. That's a little ways off, but understood. Representative Garrett, question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I don't see this as favoring construction workers over other people. I see this as this is all that's left. I mean, we used to have a Youth First program that addressed the goal of getting youth into all sorts of careers. That's gone now. So it's not like the legislature is favoring construction. That's what's left out of what used to be a much bigger job training pipeline. On the construction academies, isn't there a significant portion of private funding in the construction academies, or am I mixing that up with a different construction program?
The through the chair, Mr. Guerra, Representative Guerra, the private funding that's donated to the Alaska Construction Academy is primarily through donated equipment. Donated training instructors, donated space from school districts, and that's how they've operated from day one.
Thank you. And just
follow up, Representative Garrett.
Sure. And now that Youth First has been completely eliminated, just to refresh my memory. Youth First was largely a counseling program where where students were able to meet with job counselors across the state and try and find out what resources there were to get them into professions that they were interested in. Is that a fair description of what Youth First was?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, again, Paloma Harbor with the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. We're having to pull from our memory. The Youth First had two different parts. There was a part of it that went to the job centers for job center employees to work directly with youth and interest them in different career opportunities. And then there were the competitive grants that were awarded each year for youth training activities, such as there was actually a healthcare academy at the King Career Center in Anchorage that was funded with those that funding. But I don't remember everything that we did with that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions for the commissioner? Very good. I've been left in charge briefly, so with that, I want to thank Mr. Dreyguss and Greg and Paloma for being here. Notice for the next meeting on Monday, we'll take up the overviews for the FY budget for the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs and University of Alaska, as well as the operations, capital, and mental health budget. So with that, we are adjourned at 3:27.